Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 435.
This week on the podcast, the June corporate appropriation holiday bonanza continues.
And Biden will try literally anything to make America think that he's President Bartlett.
Plus, Rudy Giuliani didn't knowingly break the law. He was just drunk on Diet Pepsi.
And can we please put a news embargo on reporting California election results until we actually have California election results?
Plus, when will Democrats learn? Part 435 of our ongoing series.
And have you ever wondered if the current inflation was caused by something other than that one time the government sent you a measly check? We have.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Happy Father's Day.
Happy Juneteenth.
And Juneteenth.
Right. Good work to all of us for having lots of holidays in June that are all being actively colonized by corporate interests. I'm trying to think of another way of putting that. There wasn't.
No, that was the word.
Yeah.
Yeah. We knew it was Juneteenth anyway, but we were reminded yesterday when you and I were out on a little excursion and went into an ice cream store where there was a Juneteenth flavor.
That's right. What better time to buy ice cream than Juneteenth? Just as every year, it's easy to find out it's Father's Day because a lot of very gendered, very concerning gift guides appear in your inbox.
And Pride.
And Pride.
Certainly.
And right. Pride. Right. They're, like, any holiday that can be a shopping holiday is one.
That's right.
And that now includes Juneteenth.
Yep.
So congratulations,
welcome,
America. We've done it again. In any case, up top, most important news story of the week, if you ask any legitimate news source, oddly. Joe Biden fell off a bike this week. And for some reason, that was just like, I mean, that was everywhere.
Yeah. Got right back up, though. Really picked himself off. Dusted himself off.
A lesson in perseverance. And also a lesson in remembering that Americans are looking for any reason to make a West Wing reference, no matter how obscure that reference may be.
Mm-hmm.
There is a plot point in the pilot of the West Wing about President Bartlett falling off of a bike. And people are real desperate to live in Bartlett's America.
Uh-huh.
And
did it make people like him more?
I would contend that this has had no impact on Joe Biden's likability.
I know.
However, I would guess that in the West Wing pilot, things went differently.
I feel like everybody's reaction was like, he can't do anything right.
So I think the outcome was a little different. I know that they really try to like create this sense that, you know, America under Biden is like an America under Bartlett, where it's a sure and steady hand. I think there's some important things to remember about the West Wing. It's a fictional television show. Remember that. Second of all, it very carefully tried not to wade into partisan politics, which meant that President Bartlett didn't do anything partisan, which meant that President Bartlett was not a good Democrat.
Right. Well,
he was
here
just
we are.
Some guy. And so here we are. We now live in that America. And it turns out it doesn't happen the way it happens on television.
No.
I would also contend President Bartlett often had really dedicated, sharp aides walking around giving him good advice. And that is not the reality that we're in right now. So sorry about it. In any case, the one kind of great thing that's happening in America right now is these January 6th hearings. And I know that I got on this podcast last week and just lambasted them for their dumb primetime opener.
Yeah.
And I'm not sorry. I think my main frustration with that strategy became clear this week when, and these hearings were daytime hearings. There was a hearing on Monday and I think Thursday.
Yeah.
There was supposed to be one Wednesday that got pushed to Thursday. There's always a bunch of shenanigans because everyone's got COVID and no one's willing to show up places and whatnot.
Yeah.
In any case, I think that my frustration with the primetime hearing was sort of borne out by what ended up happening in these kind of amazing weekday hearings. And I think, by the way, I think that they're doing a great job of building buzz. My mom was like, you know, you don't start with a primetime hearing. You start by building buzz and you build to a primetime hearing. And I think she's right. So they are doing that and they're kind of on track for that. I think the primetime hearing was focused around human interest stories, though. And these weekday hearings have been focused around political bombshells. And I think that the message to me, at least, and often the message the Democrats have for America, is that they think we're too dumb to understand political bombshells.
Yeah.
And a hearing is really the perfect place for a political bombshell. But not only that, we have shown again and again that human interest stories don't really move the political needle at all. So we've heard the most horrifying gun violence, or we heard an 11-year-old last week tell us about gun, you know,
right.
a horrifying experience with gun violence. Those kinds of hearings, A, always come across as just like hacky political bullshit anyway, but B, they leave us with nothing to talk about later, because it's like, how much can you say about something sad that happened? You can be like, right. oh, that was sad. And then it's like, well, we did it. But you, there's no action to take after the sadness has happened. You can't be like, you know, we should arrest somebody, because there was no one, even in the, you know, in the testimony that we heard during the primetime hearings, there was no like one person to arrest. Maybe President Trump, but there was no like clear way that we could get there from her testimony. And then, you know, like, instead we were just sort of like, instead of getting our John Eastman moment, we got a getting tacos with the Proud Boys moment.
Yeah.
And I wanted the John Eastman moment to be on the 20 million viewership
totally.
Television, not the Proud Boy taco moment.
Yeah.
So in any case, let's talk about day two and three of the January 6th
hearings.
Let's
do it.
So day two. This day was mostly focused around convincing us that Trump knew that he'd lost the election, that he defrauded his followers, and it featured taped testimony with Bill Barr, the former attorney general. I think Barr was supposed to turn up in person, but then he also got COVID or got, I don't know, people,
who knows
what's going on.
Yeah.
The main takeaways. A, Donald Trump knew that he'd lost the election. Bill Barr said in a recorded deposition that he gave them that the claims of widespread election fraud were nonsense, and said that if the president currently or then believed that the election, that there was election fraud being committed, that he'd become, quote, detached from reality, and that there was never any indication or of interest in what the actual facts were on his part.
It's so interesting that they thought that he could become detached from reality, because that implies some level of
previous attachment.
Previous attachment, yes.
I thought that too.
That's like the old dad joke, you know, well, you can't go crazy if you're already there. You know, like that's a...
Exactly. But that, I think, there was a level of denialism that you will see as a pattern emerging in these hearings among his staffers. And I think that that speaks to that level of denialism. But I think, you know, Barr is the... at this point, the highest ranking official, his testimony was teased in the primetime hearings.
Yes, we saw a little bit of it.
We saw a little bit of it, but he's the highest ranking official by day two that is like, no, right. Trump knew, we told him,
right.
He was well aware that this was not a real thing.
Well, and up until, you know, think back to also when he was nominated for that job, and I don't think that this is necessarily how it turned out, but like right. Bill Barr, until becoming the attorney general, even though a Republican, a sort of broadly well-respected person.
Yes.
So
yes.
I think that is also adding to his testimony. You know, obviously the few years spent as Trump's attorney general may be outstanding. But right. like, he's like a person who has been thought of over his decades in Washington as like a somewhat like responsible human being.
He's a creature of the Beltway. He's somebody who gets invited to dinner parties. One thing I repeatedly said during this time, if you recall, which only Brent will recall because none of the rest of you will recall this, but was that one of the big liabilities in his life to being a party to something like this is that he would stop getting dinner party invites.
That's right.
Because he is somebody who was one of the few Trump officials who really was a creature of the Beltway right. and really was getting
probably
invited
very
onto
well
the dinner
liked,
party circuit.
Very well liked, probably by Joe Biden.
Yes, probably. Him and John McCain and Lindsey Graham probably had great relationships.
They were all swamping around D.C. together.
Exactly. Like, these are all people that the sort of, like, moderate social environment that is D.C., which is just a mixture of people who don't do anything in both parties, were, you know, sort of, are all sort of, like, pollinating each other. In.
Right.
And so
yeah.
he was part of that, and that's why he's the guy that was willing to come forward and do
right.
this. Even
and why his testimony has weight.
And why his testimony has weight, yeah. exactly. So with that in mind, with the knowledge that Trump knew that the election was lost, had been told that by the proper authorities,
mm-hmm.
There were kind of two teams on his staff that emerged on election night. One was led by his campaign manager, Stepien, who claims that they were part of the like reasonable group of people who tried to convince him to just concede.
Sure.
And then one was led by an apparently drunk Giuliani, who claims he was drunk on Diet Coke, although...
No, Pepsi.
I mean, Diet Pepsi. Sorry. Oh, my God.
That was the most horrifying thing of
totally
day two
it, yes.
for me. I mean, right. I have some weird takeaways here, potentially. Yeah. But I was like, well, somebody...
You can see why I'd make the mistake. Who would be addicted to Diet Pepsi?
I think it was
Pepsi?
Grant that sent us a tweet about that. And I was like, he drinks Diet Pepsi, when clearly the takeaway was that...
Right.
Everybody said that he was drunk, but it's like nobody drinks Diet Pepsi. Anyway, continue.
But so in any case, he claims he was drunk on Diet Pepsi. He was drunk on alcohol, for those interested. But he apparently, Stepien said that Giuliani had been urging the president He had been urging the president not to declare victory prematurely, and that Giuliani had been saying to ignore him and urged him to claim victory and say that the election was being stolen. So we know that he was told by multiple people around him that the election had been lost, and that the one person who told him the election hadn't been lost was a drunk Giuliani who was encouraging him to just lie.
Right.
Then the third big takeaway, thanks to Zoe Lofgren, who is a California Democrat who was in the impeachment hearing circle, the committee, on that committee, because she began her career on the Watergate investigation. So she's sure. somebody whose background was in Watergate before she came into office. She wrapped up the session laying out how his campaign had defrauded their supporters to the tune of like $250 million.
Yeah.
And that's something we're going to talk about in a bit, because that's something the Justice Department is also really interested in. But basically, they raised all this money to, quote unquote, stop the steal. And that money went towards nothing.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It was supposedly to fight election fraud.
Exactly.
That's what it was claimed anyway.
Yeah. And that opened him up to some criminal liability, because that's actual fraud.
That's right.
It's not overthrowing the government, but it is fraud.
It's wire fraud. Yeah.
It's wire fraud.
Yeah.
So in any case, so that's the takeaways from day two.
Yeah.
Day three was an adventure, you guys.
That's where it got hot.
That's where things got hot. Day three was focused on Mike Pence's role in all of this. And we learned that Trump's team continued to pressure Pence to stop the certification of the election, even after A, they knew they were breaking the law, and B, a literal riot had started. So they not only were pressuring him prior to all of this to stop certifying, to not certify the election, but they continued to keep up that pressure until after the riot.
Yeah.
Until after the coup. So,
well, and this was, keep in mind that, to kick off this coup, the speech that Trump gave was talking about if Mike Pence just does his job. I mean, they were pressuring him publicly to the rioters.
That's right.
Prior to them starting the riot.
Exactly. And what's interesting is a lot of the people who testified here saying that they, A, knew that the election had not been stolen, and B, knew that they were breaking the law, or that John Eastman was breaking the law. That's Trump's campaign lawyer, who plays a big role in this day's hearings. A lot of them still appeared at or attended that rally to encourage everyone to go behead Mike Pence. So I don't know what the hell was going on.
Which learned also in day three that they were very close to doing.
Yes, exactly.
Got within essentially 10 yards of him. Yeah.
I believe it was 40 feet.
40 feet, yeah.
Which is even closer. Than 10, I don't know.
10 yards is 30 feet. Yeah, it's 10, 11, 12 yards, 13 yards. 13 yards, 13 and a half yards.
They got within almost 10 yards of him. Listen, if there's one thing...
I wanted to pick a smaller number than 40 feet because then I thought it would sound closer, but then it involved math and I messed it up.
Yards are so hard.
Well, I was thinking football.
Yards or meters is the problem. That's why I don't approve of them. Right. In any case... Oh, yeah, that is a good football reference. And the reason I didn't understand why he was doing that is because I don't watch football.
Yeah, I was trying to do football.
In any case, okay, there's some background that you need to know here, which is that the law that they were encouraging Pence to violate is the Electoral Count Act. And that basically means that his role as vice president is also, makes him the president of the Senate. He has the sole power to determine whether or not to count states of electors presented to the joint sessions of Congress.
Yeah.
And so Eastman was suggesting to Pence that he reject states of electors based on dubious claims of voter fraud. So Pence's advisors basically were like, ignore this man.
Right. And lawyers.
Right. Yeah. His advisors, including his lawyers.
Yeah.
Were like, ignore this man. John Eastman is a fucking asshole. They said that the claims were baseless. They didn't have any historical precedents. And they, told Pence that. They also said that Cipollone, or whatever, Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, also thought that it was wrong. And that Eric Hirschman, who was Pence's lawyer, said that he told Eastman that it didn't make any sense beforehand, and that Eastman concluded it would probably also be a loser at the Supreme Court. He told them also that he said that this would cause a riot in the streets.
As
there was a riot going on in the streets, so he wasn't wrong. And apparently, Eastman just sort of like ignored it, but also the rest of these guys all just fucking shrugged their shoulders and were like, well, what can we do? So Eastman continues on, even though all of Pence's advisors are like, shut the fuck up. But then also, Jason Miller testified that leading up to the 6th, all of the attention in this circle was on whether Pence would go along with this Eastman strategy.
Yeah.
And Trump,
well, they'd been pushing it for weeks at that point.
Trump had already in December been retweeting, stuff about the election fraud that was supposedly happening. But his whole circle was consumed with whether they could get Pence to go along with this. And according to Hirschman, even Giuliani conceded that Eastman was wrong just before the January 6th rally. So Giuliani himself knew that there had not been election fraud.
But then went on stage.
But then went on stage and said that there had been. After he talked to Hirschman. But the other thing is that Eastman himself knew that he was breaking the law. And how do we know that? We know that because he pled the fifth in his own testimony.
There's a lot of fifth pleading going on. Yeah.
He, according to, I think it was Hirschman, who was one of Pence's senior aides, Eastman acknowledged to them that he knew that he was breaking the law by pushing Pence to not certify the election. So there's also eyewitness accounts that claim that he stated that he knew this was illegal. But also, we saw footage of him pleading the fifth during his own testimony. So he also knew not to incriminate himself.
Yeah.
And then, so early on...
Well, not only that. I mean, I'm skipping ahead just a little bit, but it makes sense to talk about it here. He definitely knew that he was breaking some sort of law because he asked for a pardon.
That's right.
We found that out on day three.
That's right. He tried to... So there's so many great things about this email that he sent to Giuliani. One is that is what the email actually said, which is, I've decided that I should be on the pardon list if that's still in the works. Will taint me, but given the outright lies and false witness being spewed. Okay, so that's part of it.
Yeah.
But the New York Times added some important context for me here as someone who read that and just thought, what an idiot. Because there were so many great memes going around the internet that were like, I'd like to be added to the pardon list in case that's still going around.
Right.
But the context here is that he didn't just say he wanted a pardon. He asked to be added to a known pardon list that was circulating, which means all these fools knew that they had some legal liability here and were all looking for pardons.
Yeah.
Which means that these efforts to overturn the elections that were being conducted by a larger group of Trump staffers were done with the knowledge that they had legal liability, that they might face some legal liability for doing this.
Well, so, wasn't Jared Kushner the one who claimed that he was working on the pardon list?
I think
also,
so. Somebody,
in that first primetime hearing, I think he was talking about the pardon list.
Right, because I remember that was one of the big revelations of the first primetime hearing, is that there was a pardon list. But I love the idea that John Eastman's just casually emailing Giuliani to be like, hey, I also want to be on the pardon list if that's going on.
Yeah, well, and it's why there's not really much precedent to get like a preeminent preemptive pardon.
A preemptive pardon is a very fancy pardon. A preemptive pardon. No, I mean, that's also, you don't start thinking about whether you need a pardon when you're not breaking the law.
That's right.
That's just not a thing.
Yeah.
We came really close to a constitutional crisis, though. And that's the other thing that we learned, what we tried to learn from this judge, Michael Luttig, who had very unfortunately suffered a stroke recently. And because of that, was speaking at an incredibly slow pace. And so most of the at the moment commentary about his testimony was about how no one could follow what he was saying. And because of that, it was impossible to know that what he was saying was actually like fairly important and kind of wild, which was basically, he's the one who said that we were one decision away from a constitutional crisis. He advised Pence about it at the time. And so that's why he was testifying. And that's why he very bravely came to testify, despite obviously having some speaking difficulties. But it was kind of hard to catch that because he was talking so slow. And so that's what that was all about, in case you were wondering. That was a judge telling us, a Republican judge, telling us that we almost had a major constitutional crisis if one goon had made a different choice. So that's pretty bad. But we also learned that Trump tried personally to pressure Mike Pence, and we learned that from Ivanka herself. She was, in video testimony, told the investigators that she remembered hearing a call in which he tried to bully Pence into overturning the election. And her and Trump's personal assistants witnessed a litany of names that he called Pence during this call, including a wimp, but also a pussy. So apparently he doesn't just say pussy on tour buses with Billy Bush.
She said the P word.
Right. Her aide said the P word.
Oh, the P word. Yeah. Okay, right.
That's a thing you already knew in your heart, which is that he wasn't just using locker room talk back in whatever year that was that he was on that tour bus with Billy Bush. That's a consistent theme in his life. But
I think the wildest thing that we found out during all of day three was that they continued to push all of this after January 6th. There was a failed coup attempt. And then they were like, let's try this again, guys.
So imagine that you're John Eastman, and you've come up with a cockamamie theory, which is that Mike Pence can just decide not to certify the election. And you see that your actions directly cause a massive near-constitutional crisis to happen, and also a riot.
So much so that you ask for a pardon.
So much so that you preemptively ask for a pardon. But even after the riot, he sent an email to Pence's lawyer That the Electoral Count Act had already been violated that day because the debate over Arizona's votes had exceeded 2 hours, thanks to the fucking riot that he started. And because the majority and minority leader speeches were not counted against it, we've established that the Electoral Count Act isn't as sacrosanct as you made it out to be. So could Pence just break it one more time and just fucking do this, quote, relatively minor violation and send the votes back to the states? Pence apparently, so his lawyer did not show him this until a few days later, Pence's. Uh-huh. And apparently when Pence saw it, he called it, quote, rubber room stuff, which is the most Midwestern way of saying something is fucking batshit bananas that I've ever heard in my life. I love that, rubber room stuff. But apparently there was also a plan B that involved Pence suspending the joint session and determining that the time restrictions are contrary to his authority under the 12th Amendment and therefore void. Eastman was like looking for literally anything.
Yeah.
And hilariously, so was Ted Cruz, because one of the most hilarious things that I think I saw in the coverage of this was that John Eastman's plan is actually quite close to some of the things that Ted Cruz proposed in the lead up to the riot itself. And I love that both of them, professional lawyers, thought that the best way to proceed in this circumstance was to blatantly break the law.
Well, I'm curious if some people will, you know, because Giuliani lost his license.
Yeah.
To practice. So,
certainly
I mean,
John Eastman should lose his license.
John Eastman should too.
I would say Ted
yeah.
Cruz, just as too. A general principle, right. should lose his license.
Yeah.
So, okay. This is the important thing to review here, because we learned a lot on day three.
Yeah.
And so much so that some of that should have been in prime time, if anything was going to be in prime time.
Yeah.
So far, I would say that nothing really deserved to be in prime time, but that event, John Eastman's testimony was really the one.
Yeah.
Not his testimony, because he pled the fifth for his testimony.
Well, right.
But just
what
we learned about him in that time. I think the important takeaways here are that this, and this is why I think it's so important to start like building a case that really like gets some buzz going.
Yeah.
Is we learned that this attempt to overturn the election was not just like a random confluence of weird events from evil players that were acting individually, but a real conspiracy.
Yeah.
And that people inside of it saw that there was a conspiracy happening and chose to either, you know, be involved or not be involved, but nobody stopped it.
Yeah.
None of the people in the inside circle who were well aware that the Trump campaign lawyer was actually actively seeking to break the law and, you know, steal an election.
Yeah.
None of those people did anything about that. They were just like, dude, stop doing this. Nobody liked John Eastman. All of them talked about how annoying he was. All of them talked about how annoyed they were with him, and also that he even knew himself that he was being an asshole. And yet nobody did anything. So the sort of main takeaway here is the Trump campaign actually engaged in a literal conspiracy to overthrow the election.
Yeah.
In a way that I think it's hard to wrap your mind around in the US context, but in a way that is like, that's what Watergate was all about, you guys.
Right.
So like right now we're in real Watergate territory. This is and Watergate, by comparison, is the most piddly thing I've ever heard of in my life. I mean, I know Watergate, the larger conspiracy, involved much more than just that one break-in to the DNC offices. But I'm just saying, like, when we think about what we should now be contextualizing January 6th as, it was a conspiracy to overturn the election by dishonest players who were inside the government.
Yeah.
And that is a pretty big deal. So I would say start tuning in if you're not. Now, I get, like, listen, did we watch all these hearings live? No, of course not. They were at 7 a.m. our time.
I know.
I'm just saying the next time there's a primetime hearing, consider tuning in.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And I also think this is the time to start talking up what's going on with your friends.
Yeah.
Because this is, there are some real conspiracy points that are actually true, that are not controversial, you know, interpretations of what's going on that that we could be talking about now.
Yeah.
And let's build a buzz. And one of the reasons is A, Jamie Raskin says that more GOP officials are starting to come forward now, probably because they're a little bit worried about their own liability, including Ginny Thomas.
Yeah.
So
she said she'd speak to them.
She said she'd speak to them. So that's a pretty big deal. There's a tip line.
Well, because I think we found out that she was maybe a little bit more involved. Hadn't she made some calls to some of these people in addition to just the text? Yeah, I think we learned that this week also.
So,
not at the hearings, I think just generally.
No, just in life.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So Ginny Thomas is suddenly willing to chat, but we could pressure more of these people too.
Yeah.
But there's also a sort of separate thing going on, which is that the Justice Department is looking into some of these revelations and seeing if maybe Trump is going to face some legal liability himself.
Well, that's the thing. I think a lot of people have sort of been questioning as to whether, you know, obviously we've just gone through all of the litany of the things that all of these other people did that were very illegal. But like the DOJ has sort of like kept pretty close to the vest as to whether they're actually investigating Trump. But it seems like there were a few moments from both of these days that seemed like they really sort of like set the stage for like possible charges against Trump in the way that we probably didn't get in that first hearing, at least specifically, because and you're starting to hear, you know, some sort of like ex-Justice Department officials and other people being like, oh, maybe there's something there in terms of like actually charging Trump. And we sort of mentioned it earlier. Certainly what they are calling on the House panel the big ripoff, which was the defrauding of all of his people who donated to that $250 million election defense fund, because they sort of set the stage for like him knowing that he was lying about that and that that money wasn't going to where he told the people who gave it to him was actually going. So that's something that we now feel like, oh, that feels like something that he himself could be charged with. So that's interesting. And then we also found out the one thing that we do know that the Justice Department has been looking into is the Eastman plan to like seat different electors.
Yes.
So we, and there's already a grand jury for that. And we also found out about that from January 6th too. So we've kind of, we sort of now have our first like official crossover of something that January 6th is presenting as evidence that we know that the DOJ is looking into.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think Merrick Garland this week was asked about it and he was like, we're watching. I think they asked for some transcripts for the first
time.
They did,
yeah.
So it seems like there's maybe they're putting some meat on the bones for like actual charges for Trump. And that's really what I, you know, like
that's what I care
you
about.
Watched, I was going to say, you watched more of these like in the moment than I did. I certainly saw, I feel like, the important clips over time of just like being a news watcher. But like I have said to you, I think multiple times over the course of the last week, like text me when someone's in handcuffs.
Exactly.
And I realize we're like, that's not going to be happening in the next 2 weeks or anything. But like, I think that like, these last few days gave me some more hope that like I would be seeing some people carted away and potentially even Trump himself.
Yeah, and I think also this committee is building a case that really will make the DOJ look negligent if no one's charged with anything. Like at this point, it's clear that there was like a very high level and very alarming conspiracy afoot that Trump was both aware of and was participating in on across numerous avenues of crime. Because there was the fraud, but Trump was also personally involved in trying to convince Mike Pence to overturn the election results. So Donald Trump had his personal hand in almost all of this.
Yeah. And it seems like there's reasonable proof that he knew that all of this was both illegal and like, you know, not real.
Right. His only real defense here is the insanity defense. And I just don't think that's a good one either.
No.
Because he was the president at the time. I don't know, you guys. But in any case, I think, look, there's going to be pressure building on the opposite end of this that's just like, this is political and about the election and whatever. And I would just warn everyone that these kinds of things only happen when it's election time. So hang on, because this is what you get.
Yeah.
And nobody does anything when it's not election time, as we learned, because this could have happened last year and it didn't.
Right.
So,
well, and that's the other thing. When you talk about the pressure on the DOJ, that pressure already existed.
Exactly.
Like there are people who for the last 2 years have been like hot mad that the Garland Justice Department like seems to have not been doing anything. Now, granted, they've been investigating some of these things, but it's sort of like, I think a lot of people are sort of like, where are the charges?
Yeah.
And I think now that we've had, you know, 3 days of this, the calls for where are the charges are going to get like very loud for the Justice Department.
And they should.
And they should
also
be, yeah, right?
It takes something like this. I mean, you know, one thing I always have to remember is that Richard Nixon got reelected in the middle of Watergate. Like these things happen slowly. Oftentimes, stupidly slowly.
Yeah.
And then at the end, it seems so inevitable that you're like, why did that fucking take so long?
Right.
But we are in the middle, because we're only 2 years out, or 2.5 years out, or whatever. We're in the middle of this moment right now.
Yeah.
And while I think in this case, this is so egregious and so scary and dangerous that we should act more quickly than we did in the case of Watergate, I also think that it would be nice to start. This is about the time that you should expect to see some momentum building, and we should we should absolutely participate in building that momentum in any way that we can as regular people. And this is the best thing about all of this, you guys. the best way that you can participate in building momentum here is to gossip.
Gossip. I was going to say.
Like, even, this is glorious.
Right. Even if you hardly processed any of what we just told you, tomorrow morning,
tell everyone.
Say to your friends, did you hear about that John Eastman testimony?
Exactly.
And like, and they'll be like, no, what was it? And just make something up.
Doesn't matter. The best thing that we can do right now is to all gossip together. And that's really the greatest gift of all. So
yeah.
With that in mind, let's talk about some elections.
Listen, we do this all the time. And yeah. We warned against this. But like, the news media never learns. And they don't really care. And we're never going to see a big storyline on CNN. They're never going to have election night in America and retell us the actual results from the California election because they think that they did it 2 weeks ago and that was that. But guys, they are all wildly different than you heard about on Tuesday night.
As is the case after every California election,
yeah.
The results have shifted dramatically to the left since the last time you checked in.
Yes. Like to the point where like, I think I mentioned this on the podcast last week, but like I had people being like, oh God, what a bad night for progressives last night.
Yes.
We're not going to be able to do student debt cancellation because Karen Bass lost to Rick Caruso. Well, that didn't happen.
Nope.
That was always a ridiculous take anyway. But I mean, she's way ahead.
That's right.
Way ahead.
In current standing, she's 6 points ahead. And that we're not even done counting the ballots yet.
No.
And reminder
she
that
was she behind
was,
on
she
election
was behind
night.
On election night and massively outspent. And also, yeah. There were other progressive candidates in the race with her.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking about a progressive vote that was split at the time.
Oh, well, that's the other thing. You know, I think that the state or the county Democrats have already come out and they're now declaring her the only Democrat in the race, which I think is smart because, like, people are going to be inclined in Los Angeles to vote for a Democrat. And Rick Caruso claims he's won. But, like, that's the other thing. I think when you look at how that – and I'm not saying everybody who voted for Kevin DeLeon is going to vote for Karen Bass or everybody who voted for whoever.
Who knows who any
of these people
are.
But, I mean, like, I've got to assume that the bulk of the rest of the vote – Rick Caruso got 36% of the vote. I would think that – the rest of that 64 is probably more inclined to vote for Karen Bass than they are for Rick Caruso. So
yeah.
I think it actually gets harder for him in a general, which is why he spent so much money in the primary because he wanted to get to 50% in the primary.
That's right.
So I don't think Rick Caruso is going to win in the fall. And you should still carry on as if you're concerned about him doing so. But like, it gets harder for him now. So like all of this news about, you know, Rick Caruso, rich Republican, sending shockwaves through Los Angeles is garbage.
That's right.
Forget about that.
And I think what
it's not
happened,
real.
Like, I think that we also need to make a distinction between, it is absolutely right for people before election night to start to panic about things like this because it drives voter turnout and it gets people invested in the race results. I think that oftentimes media will draw a logical conclusion from all of that panic that isn't actually correct about how things happen. So I think, you know, they heard that all of these people on the left were worried about Rick Caruso and Rick Caruso might get to 50% and it was a big deal.
Yeah.
And so they reported that he had done really well, even though, like, you know, when the votes were actually going to be counted, it was going to be clear that this was like a big fail for him.
Yeah.
And that was a direct, because that story had been built in people's minds, everyone was willing to believe it because they were just like, oh, well, of course he did really well. They told us he was going to do really well.
Yeah.
That's why we were so worried and our worst fears came true. And oftentimes that happens in these races where our worst fears look like they have come true on election night. And it turns out that when you haven't counted any percentage of the votes, you don't actually know anything.
Well, and we truly didn't know anything because that's not the only race that has flipped since election night. Because Hugo Soto Martinez is now leading Mitch O'Farrell. This is LA City Council, who's a two-term
incumbent. And I think he's
a DSA. Yeah, DSA. Okay. He's a labor organizer. He's ahead by 8 points. Community activist Eunices Hernandez is ahead of
Gil
Cedillo. And Eunices Hernandez is over 50% right now.
Yeah.
So they may not even
also
have
DSA,
a...
Also DSA, I believe.
She's like a community activist.
Yeah.
Like, so that's not even going to go to a runoff. And then additionally, in addition to those quote-unquote big races, which I think people think of, you know, the mayor and city council.
Well, also, there were a few of those where I think Hugo Soto Martinez's race and Eunices Hernandez's race were against incumbents, but there were a bunch of open seats as well.
Right. Well, and also, you know, there's a progressive, Kenneth Mejia, who is running for city controller. He's an accountant, and he's called for major reductions in police spending. He's now ahead. Well, more ahead. He was already ahead, but he's ahead by 19 points in the city controller race. City attorney candidate Faisal Gill, who's promised not to enforce the city's anti-camping ordinance, he's more ahead now than he was as well. And then also the civil rights lawyer Aaron Darling has a 5-point lead over municipal law attorney Tracy Park.
Yeah, and Mike Bonin's district.
Bonin's old
and that
district.
Was a real. So Mike Bonin actually pulled out of the race late, and Aaron Darling was a Darling was a late entrant into that race. And Mike Bonin had been a fairly progressive city council member, and so people were really concerned because the Tracy Park pulled ahead. As soon as that was the case, and she's not progressive.
Yeah.
And Aaron Darling, 4 months ago, no one knew who he fucking was.
Yeah, exactly. And almost every one of these people that are now ahead were in second place on Tuesday night.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's, as usual, been, I think we're often left with the impression that we got on election night when we read the headlines regarding what happened. And because the headlines often read as if they're definitive results to pull out of these early, you know, results, I think... Yeah. That we're often sort of like left behind the eight ball. I mean, another exciting outcome is that maybe a girl is in second place against Adam Schiff.
Yeah,
Adam Schiff's challenger is going to be from the left this time.
Yep.
It's going to be a drag queen from the left because we are the West Hollywood and Silver Lake District and we deserve that.
That's right. We do.
But I mean, we have been trying for years to pull a progressive candidate into the general with him instead of a Republican.
Finally did
and
that.
And finally achieved that. So we're, the results, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think maybe a girl is going to win that race, but I think that having the main challenge in the race come from the left is going to pose a different set of questions for someone like Adam Schiff, who has been running as if his opponent is on the right and has been running as a fairly moderate candidate in this district for a long time. I am kind of excited to see what happens with some of these races where the second place finisher ended up being a progressive and not a moderate Republican. And those are also results that are getting underreported because obviously no one's reporting on the Adam Schiff race results because who fucking cares? He got a zillion percent of the vote. And in those races, if you get over 50%, you don't automatically get the seat.
Right. It's only city races.
It's only city races where that's
maybe
the case.
County. I can't remember.
But, yeah. I don't know what happens in the county races. But so in any case, so there is going to be a runoff in all of those races.
Yeah.
So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. But I mean, like if most of those results hold, then like the city hall is going to move further to the left, not to the right.
Well, I mean, I think there was all of this, you know, this consternation because they, you know, they were redistricting Nithya Raman's district to basically try to get her out of the city council. And they were basically, the city council put up all these walls because of Nithya Raman's win last election, put up all these walls to new younger progressives getting in. And those walls did not stop this from happening.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, because it's there's still not a ton of progressives in City Hall, but I was seeing something that... that Bonin had said, because for a long time, he was really the only true progressive vote there. And then Nithya Raman was there. And he was like, you know, it's lonely when you're one, but when there's two, it's easy to get four. And when there's four, it's easier to get eight.
And
right?
just a you reminder, know, I, there's only like, 15 city councilors in LA. 50,
right,
so it's not that hard to get 15
right.
if you work, if it's multiplying in that way.
Right. Or certainly to get a majority.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
Yeah. So that's, I think, what they're working to do. So anyway, and in addition, just sort of like a thing that sort of like makes me even happier is that in almost every single race where the California Apartment Association and the Los Angeles Police Protective League spent significant sums of money, and they spent millions of dollars, by the way, almost in every single one of those races, their favorite candidates wound up in second place. Now, in some instances, they made it to a runoff, so they haven't necessarily fully lost yet. But it's just delicious to see them spend millions of dollars and then like not have anything to show for themselves.
I love when money doesn't buy you votes.
I know.
It's my favorite thing.
It's the best.
Meanwhile, some troubling signs for National Democrats in Texas and everywhere.
Yeah.
Including in LA. And this is why, by the way, I feel like you should always be... thinking about what trends you're seeing at the local level and how they're going to translate into national politics, because the local level is really where sort of political coalition building begins. But we're looking right now at a GOP flip in South Texas that is showing that the winds are blowing in a fairly unfavorable direction towards Democrats in some areas of Texas, and probably as a result, areas of the rest of the Southwest that are not great for Democrats.
And we've been seeing this, right? I mean, I think it's been going on for a while, but certainly in 2020, you know, I think Republicans themselves were even surprised that, you know, in places that Hillary Clinton had won by landslides, like the, along the border, that Trump did much better in 2020. Like, yeah. Biden barely carried. So, like, this has been something that we've known about, which I think is sort of, like, what brings how this race went down into question, because the Republicans spent a lot of money on this. And it was sort of just so they could say that they got a flip, because this is to finish out a term, and then the district gets way,
this district goes away, right? Yeah.
And then it gets redistricted into another district, which is like plus Democrats 100, essentially. Right. So this Republican is probably not going to win in November. But there are still some troubling signs that, like, a lot of Latino leaders, like, literally went to Sean Patrick Maloney on the House floor, and they were like, look, like, we understand why you didn't put a ton of money into this special, but, like, we need help down there.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's, like, three or four people who represent those border communities in South Texas that are all getting challenged
from the right.
And they're spending a ton of money down there. And so the fact that the Democrats haven't chosen to protect those people in any sort of meaningful way, when the Republicans have said clearly in public that they are eyeing all of these districts, like, it just seems like it's a problem for the Democrats to sort of, like, not... It's a problem that they don't see it as a problem.
Well, and it's also a trend that's been happening for a while, where Democrats have been losing Latino support for a long time. And because it, you know, I think it often gets a little bit confused in the primary season, because, you know, Bernie Sanders had a huge amount of Latino support.
Totally.
And so some of the progressive candidates that run do end up with a huge amount of Latino support. But moderate Democrats have been sort of shedding Latino support at a very alarming rate. And you can see why.
I was going to say,
it's been clear why. There's been no immigration reform. Like, none of the issues that Latino voters claim to care about are being addressed by Democrats, which
if you want to look at a real eye-opening map, open up the map to the 2020 Texas Democratic primary and see who won in what areas.
Yeah.
And you might be surprised.
Yeah.
Or if you've been listening to this podcast, you won't be. But Bernie Sanders, in a epic blowout along the border.
Yes. Yeah. No, and I think when you think about the kinds of the issues he was focusing on there, the fact that he worked really, his campaign worked really hard to engage voters in Latino communities. You know, they hired outreach directors that spoke Spanish. His national outreach director was Latina. Like, they, you know, after 2016, realized that they needed to do the work to gain the trust of Latino voters, and really went and did that work.
Yeah.
And so you can see why those voters were engaged.
Yeah.
Along the border. But you can also see that in general races with other, like, sort of mainline Democrats, you're not seeing that same trend. You're seeing the opposite trend. It's something Joaquin Castro talked about a lot when he was running for president.
Yeah.
Julian Castro ran for president.
Yeah.
You guys, it's so hard with identical twins.
Right.
Like, and their names both start with J's. This is like dressing your twins the same. It's a lot to expect. Joaquin Castro has a beard now, though, so that's how we're supposed to tell them apart.
No,
in any case, when Julian Castro was running for president, he spoke a ton about this, about the ways in which Democrats were failing to engage Latino voters, and how, you know, and that one of the ways they were failing to engage them is that, you know, immigration reform just, like, fell off the table completely. They really haven't done what they've needed to do to protect Dreamers. They haven't done the cost of living, you know, like apple pie. What am I trying to say?
Kitchen table.
Kitchen table work that affects all communities, but especially communities that are living closer to the poverty line. Like, they really haven't done the work. And this is something that has been known and spoken about pretty openly in certain sectors of the Democratic Party for a long time.
Yeah.
However, even with that knowledge, we're having to, you know, we're watching Congress members from border regions and Congress members from heavily Latino districts having to go to the D-Trip and be like, dude, this is, like, supposed to be like a fairly safe demo for us. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
So.
Yikes.
If there's one person I would trust not to know any of this, it's Sean Patrick Maloney. So I guess that's something to speak about. Oh, also, speaking of Texas, an amazing thing has happened, which is, I think, a perfect example of why you don't collaborate. Just collaborate in the World War II sense, not collaborate in general. You should collaborate with people. It's great. Group work is great. But why you don't collaborate with the enemy? Because the Texas GOP is having their party convention, and they decided that the log cabin Republicans couldn't come.
They denied both local chapters and the state chapter to have a booth at the convention.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious because their state party chair said, I think they made the right decision, like whoever decided.
Right.
I think they made the right decision based on our rule on booth approval. I think it's inappropriate given the state of our nation right now for us to play sexual identity politics, which is hilarious because they're currently trying to ban drag queens in Texas.
Yeah.
Right now.
The same amongst, Texas party that doesn't care about identity right, politics.
Amongst every single other Republican state, you know, banning transgender, you know, girls playing sports and various other things. I mean, like, they are the leading
they're
party
so obsessed
of
with sexual
politics,
identity
right?
politics.
Yeah, exactly. That's who they are and what they do. So the idea that, like, they don't want to be those guys is
too amazing.
Rich. Yeah.
But also, don't be a log cabin Republican.
I mean, hello.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
It's oof. Like, God. In any case, some bad 2024 news.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't want to totally belabor this point because we talked about it on the podcast last week, but there was an article this week about like how Biden is doing a lot of things that like indicate that he's running. But when we were talking last week, I said the one thing that was going to piss me off is that if the Democrats somehow or another don't plan for Biden not to run and then get caught with their pants down.
Yeah.
Like I remember saying that phrase on last week's
sure
podcast.
Did.
So like they go through all of the things that he's doing. He's like planning a re-election announcement in 2023 based on Obama's timetable, and they're flooding battleground states with all of this money to build up their operations in 2024 and blah 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 blah. But then also in this article it says, under the Biden team's leadership, the Democratic National Committee has decided against preparing a debate schedule for a contested nomination fight.
Come on.
So that got me big mad because that is just exactly what they would do. And then all of a sudden he decides he doesn't run. He falls off a bike one too many times, whatever it is. And then they're going to be like, oh, we forgot to plan debates and primaries and know who a good candidate would be. And I see it already.
Yeah.
Right.
No, well,
I mean, it would be exactly what they would do.
It's the most predictable kind of DNC failure that you can imagine, which is why we know it will for sure happen.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And it leaves us with no good outcome because Biden running is also a terrible outcome. So there's actually no win now for us here.
Right.
Like, this is a terrible plan.
Yeah. And speaking of 2024.
Yes.
Although I don't even know if I really mean this with an eye towards 2024. Maybe you'll chime in on this. You have some thoughts. Yeah. There was a debate this week between Bernie Sanders and Lindsey Graham that was hosted by Fox News. And
I love when a progressive shows up at a Fox News debate. I love when Bernie Sanders is on Fox.
And he, first off, for starters, just seemed far livelier than Biden. Like if we're thinking about who is going to be able to like seem the most engaged on the campaign trail of the people who are octogenarians, I feel
if there's one thing that I feel like I know as a native New Yorker, it's that angry old New Yorkers are some of the most energetic
people on
earth.
He's gonna be fine for a while. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is a man who's still like out there playing basketball and doing whatever else he's doing. Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, look, maybe it's just because it's been a minute since I've seen his sort of like campaign shtick, like the usual song and dance, which I am obviously partial to as a longtime Bernie Sanders supporter.
Right.
But there is part of me that, like, first off, he just laid waste to Lindsey Graham, by the way.
I mean,
which is what everybody is talking about.
Yeah.
Like, people are talking about that debate. Fox News, like, ran it. I think they, like, streamed it on something. They're putting it on the air. And I'm sure it's because it was spicy.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, it just, like, hearing somebody so coherently talk about, you know, the entrenched political powers screwing us all over right now, and how we're paying more for health insurance, and we're paying more for prescription drugs, and you know all of these corporations like are screwing us over, and like it just felt like, oh, that's the message.
Yeah.
That, like,
especially in this moment where every store in America is unionizing.
And I've thought that's the message for the last two times. So like maybe I'm delusional. I don't know. But
well, you're not, because the last two times that was a very resonant message, and then it got squashed by those very corporate entrenched powers,
right, exactly. So it just feels like even more right now, because you know what? Republicans are going to run on that, interestingly.
Yes. No.
And they're not going to mean it. They're going to be disingenuous about it. But like, I think
when you cede populism to the right, they run with it too. That's the thing about populism, is it's simple.
Yes.
So you can run on it from any side.
Right.
The reason
exactly
it works is because it's good sounding ideas.
Yeah. Like, I just can't imagine how you wouldn't think that was a better campaign message than like, let's do incremental change and work together in harmony.
Yeah. Especially because we've shown that A, no one can work together in harmony right. anymore, and B, incremental change means nothing.
Yeah.
I am hoping, listen, I think that Bernie Sanders is also too old to run. I think most of these fools are too old to run.
I get it.
And I,
but yeah, I don't know that he's necessarily, like, I would prefer someone else be delivering that message.
Yes.
But I will say, I think seeing that, I have now decided that if no one else is willing to deliver that message, I am there and will do everything that I can to get an 84-year-old elected to president, and I will not blink about it.
I feel the same way. I feel like in a vacuum, then Bernie Sanders is the, if he's the guy. Yeah.
Well, I've always said I would vote for the ghost of Bernie Sanders.
Well, exactly. I will vote for whoever's delivering the message. The message is what matters to me, I think, in the end. With that said, I think that the one thing that I really like about the Sanders movement is it has done a good job of building a bench. There are progressives, low-level newer progressives, young progressives that are running on that very message everywhere right now. And so while I think that maybe 2024 is like, you know, this is a message that really only gained popularity in 2016, and because of that, there hasn't been enough time to build entrenched power with that message.
Yeah.
I do think that there is a group of people coming.
Yeah.
That, like,
well, and they should run for practice, if nothing else. And they should primary Biden, too, by the way.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. I think that, like, if we have learned anything from Donald Trump, it's that any idiot can run for president. And so I think that maybe my hope is that if Bernie Sanders isn't, you know, if we don't want an 84-year-old to run for president, which I don't particularly want,
right.
I think I trust the people that are running in the Sanders mold to do something in a way that I don't trust the center. I trust, you know, there's going to, and listen, I know Pete Buttigieg has his eye on things too. And I know that's not great. No. And I know that he's been propped up in a way that none of those progressives have been propped up.
Yeah.
I think the one thing that he lacks is the kind of grassroots enthusiasm that follows a lot of progressive lawmakers as they go and try to do new things. So I think this 2024 could be a shit show. I'm not promising anything for 2024. Mm-hmm. I think, though, that of any of these people, Sanders has one of the better chances of having a younger Bernie Sanders appear behind him than, you know, I guess Pete Buttigieg is the Joe Biden appearing behind him. I mean, I get that there's some of these people out there on the right, too. I just think that a lot of these moderate and center right Democrats are sort of in their heyday. You know, I think Pete Buttigieg looks like an anachronism. He looks like he's from another time. And I think that, you know, when I think about what the sort of faces of leadership that are emerging on the left, on the sort of Sanders coalition left, we're talking about people like Chris Smalls. You know, we're not talking about somebody who looks like they stepped out of a Midwestern suburb 2 days ago
McKinsey.
And have never been in America. Right. Exactly. Not a McKinsey alum.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty exciting, actually, because I think that's what I'm sort of hoping the face of the new left is, that it's not Pete Buttigieg's who are just, like, you know, mansplaining the left to you as opposed to the middle to you.
Yeah.
But I think that there's maybe, like, an opportunity to, for the left to start thinking about some of these practice runs.
Yeah.
Because while I promise nothing for 2024, that could be a total shit show for the left. I think there's like a lot coming for us. Whereas I don't think there's much coming for the middle. I think after Pete Buttigieg, we might have exhausted the middle.
Well, we've already thankfully eliminated Connor Lamb as an option.
I mean, and I think that's the perfect example.
Right.
You know, I think
that we've decided against those people.
We've decided against those people. And so I think that Pete Buttigieg can run, and maybe he'll get, he would get a certain distance based on the help of big moneyed interests. I actually don't think that this would be a good year for him because he can't deliver that kind of populist messaging in a way that actually holds up to scrutiny.
Yeah.
Whereas I think a Sanders-like person can. But there are Sanders-like people out there.
Right.
We're not in a situation like we were in 2016 or 2020 even, where it's just like him and like AOC.
Right.
We have we have a real coalition out there.
Yeah.
Optimism maybe not being a trendy thing to feel at the moment.
Yeah.
I think that the resonance of the message is what's most important here. And so we should just always be looking for victories in messaging and not worrying about whether Bernie Sanders is too old or too young or whatever. Somebody can be Bernie Sanders after Bernie Sanders.
Right. Yes.
And if nothing else, there's other old Jewish people out there.
Sure.
You know, as angry old Jewish people, literally everywhere.
Yes.
Let's talk about inflation. And not in a factual way.
No, well,
in a feelings way.
Yeah, I was having an interesting conversation with somebody earlier this week who is a person who isn't necessarily, like, a political thinker, but, like, is a person who sort of watches the news and knows the things that are going on and certainly lives in the world. He's right. not a trillionaire. He's right. a regular human. And he said to me this week, he was like, I just sort of like don't understand why it is that everybody is on TV telling me that the reason that we're having such bad inflation is because there's so much money in the economy and people have too much money to spend, because I haven't had a raise in, you know, a better part of a decade.
Right.
And like, I just sort of like don't get that. And I was like, well, you bring up a fucking interesting point.
Right.
Because that math ain't mathin'.
That's right.
And I'm with, but it made me curious as to whether other John Q. Public people are also putting those things together in a way that I wouldn't necessarily have thought about until I was having this conversation with this person. So, and so that's our talking question. Point.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, literally every economist, literally every economist is giving this incredibly dishonest take on the inflation situation. That's like a knee-jerk take.
Yeah.
That's like, oh, we must be having inflation because the government gave away money.
Right.
Not acknowledging that when the government gave away money, no one fucking had any, first of all. The government didn't give away money to people who weren't going to spend it, because there was a cap on who got the money. It wasn't like trillionaires got the money.
Yeah.
But also, there's this important missing talking point from that conversation, which is the government gave us all like $2,000.
Yeah.
But the very wealthiest among us have accumulated wealth at a rate that surpasses like human imagination and my math skills.
Well, that's
why is that not related to this conversation at all?
Because if the thing that is causing inflation is, well, one important thing that they're leaving out is that inflation is due to both supply and demand.
Exactly.
Right? So everybody everybody's only talking about the demand side when it's obviously...
Right, when the supply side has been a huge factor because we've been living in a pandemic.
Right. But if people want to talk about ways to get money out of the economy, I've got some fucking ideas for them.
I mean,
that don't involve getting workers' wages down, which is what Jerome Powell was talking about this week, that head of the Fed. It's to repeal $4 or $5 trillion worth of tax cuts.
That's right.
That would get money out of the economy by forcing people to pay taxes. Because guess what happens when you pay taxes? It doesn't go into a checking account at the Fed.
No.
It just gets taken out. It gets flushed down a toilet at the Fed. That's what happens to it. So like, there are ways to get money out of the U.S. economy that aren't just making sure poor people don't have any money.
Well, I was going to say, like, the problem isn't that we're all having too medium of a standard of living.
Right.
The problem is that there is a huge amount of money in the economy, and it's all it's all being focused on the very wealthy.
Right. Right. This idea that because Donald Trump 2.5 years ago sent you $2,000 broke the entire U.S. economy is nonsense.
I would believe his tax cuts did. I would believe that years of Republican tax cuts might be behind this.
Yeah, repeal the Bush ones too.
I would also believe that we are living in an extraordinary time where we are contending with some very complicated factors that affect both supply and demand for products and services and such. And that because of that, we may need to adjust our economic policies to ensure that everyone maintains a high standard of living amidst that kind of chaos.
Yeah.
And that the answer to the question of why is there inflation is never middle class and poor people have $2,000.
Right.
The question you ask is, how do we combat inflation without having without having to create a permanent underclass?
Right.
And I just think, you know, like so many things in, you know, economics, in the quote unquote social science of economics. And remember, it's a social science. It's not a hard science. And as my grandfather always said, it's for charlatans. It's not even a real social science. But I mean, like, I don't understand why the focus is of these conversations is never what steps do we need to take to solve the problem in a way that's best for everyone. The questions are always like, what do we need to take away from regular people so rich people don't have to worry about this thing anymore?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I also, we made up the economy. Again, inflation is a result of a made up set of rules in a made up economy.
Well, and it's a result of a million different things.
And it's a result of a million different things.
Not the result of you getting $2,000.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this sort of simple, the people who are using that simple explanation have an agenda.
Yeah.
It's not like they know for sure that the one time the government gave people public assistance, it caused massive inflation. That's why we can never do that again. You just have to starve because they can't give you $2,000 at a time where everyone had to stop making money at once.
Yep.
The question is, how do we ensure that supply and demand are being met in equitable ways?
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. But I just think, you know, I think that what was, just going back to that conversation I had, what was interesting about that is I think that a lot of times, like, people, the everyday people, I think, are too scared to trust their instincts when it comes to, like, the economy, because they think that they can't understand it.
Well, and also, and I think they think that they're going to be asked for solutions, and it's really not your job to know why this is happening. Right. It's your job to put two and two together and be like, oh, this reason they gave me doesn't make sense.
But that's what I was
going
to say. Yeah. I think if you are a person who's out there thinking to themselves, like, the reasons that I'm being given for this, like, don't totally add up, don't question yourself.
Yeah.
Because you're right. Like, this is, to some degree, it's easier than you think also, right?
Well, I mean, also, I think if everyone voted according to their own personal economic interests in a meaningful way,
sure,
then we probably wouldn't have this wild rightward swing going on in the country right now, because everyone's needs are fairly similar. People, for the most part, really want the same things. They're being given a lot of crazy reasons for why these things are happening. And in the same, you know, along the same vein that you're being told that, like, the one time the government gave out equitable sums of money to people that somehow caused the economy to crash, you're also being told that, you know, immigrants are taking your jobs. I mean, these are all things that are not the real thing.
Yeah.
The real thing is more systemic than these little, you know, than these sort of, like, little things. So I also think, like, to some extent, if everyone just thought to themselves, does this make sense in my situation?
Yeah.
And didn't even worry about whether it makes sense broadly. You're not an economist. What do you know? What do I know? I mean, I don't know anything. But I mean, like, it just thought, does this make sense to me in my case personally? Did this $2,000 significantly change my buying power?
Yeah.
Or does the fact that I haven't gotten a, you know, a wage increase, or a real, you know, that my wages haven't kept up with inflation for any of the last million years, does that seem like a more compelling sort of force in my life?
Yeah.
And I would guess that you've lost more than $2,000 in inflation, non-wage increases, than you've gained in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's another thing to keep in mind. Somehow the economy functioned before we stopped getting raises.
Right.
And it could function again. And at the time that it functioned the best, we were taxing rich people at an incredibly high rate, and we were giving away so much shit it's impossible to imagine.
Right.
Like, my grandfather got a free fucking doctorate from the U.S. government. That was a time that existed in society.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make sense the way that this is being framed.
Yeah.
No, and I think that's part of the reason people don't think that they're worthy of understanding it.
Because
they're constantly giving incongruous facts and then being told they're too dumb to understand it. And it's like, no, you're not.
It's complicated.
It's not that complicated. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But I think in news, contrary news to this, people are unionizing out there at a rate that really can't be overstated.
We had our first Apple store.
I know.
Just recently, just this week, yesterday, Saturday.
I am
so good.
Loving that. So many of the places that are unionizing, inspired by fast food unionizing workers, by the way, are these sort of, like, bougie brands.
I know. It's great.
Like, it really, that's why I love that Starbucks is doing it, because they were for years being touted as an example of a company that treated their employees better than other companies. And it's like, on what scale are we even talking about here? I mean, some of these companies treat their employees like total absolute garbage. It's better to have a company that sort of theoretically treats you like only medium garbage. The excuses that we hear for why it's for why Starbucks was such a great employer are always so ludicrous. But so I love to watch these, you know, these sort of bougier brands where, you know, I know that this isn't the case at Apple stores, but we associate Apple with high wages. Because Apple employees who work on the sort of tech side get very high wages. And so we forget that there's this, like, underclass of Apple workers who work for shitty wages in a retail environment, and that they deserve protections.
In
the richest corporation on the fucking planet.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. No. So, and also, as if their labor is any less valuable to the company, because I think that's the other thing is, like, labor is incredibly valuable.
I was going to say, that's how they're making all their money, is pushing software or pushing hardware. And, like, the way that you get hardware is from these people.
Exactly. AOC did a really great series on her Insta stories this week about the inherent value of service sector labor. Because she got some question from someone that was like, I make more money as a bartender than I would make doing something else, but I feel guilty because I feel like everyone thinks that no one should be a bartender that long, whatever. And she was like, the idea that that work, A, doesn't require any skills, and B, doesn't provide any value, is so absurd.
Yeah.
And also, and then went and did, you know, listed out all of the skills that you get as someone who works in the service sector, and all of the value that you provide to a company as someone in the service sector. And it's so, like, wild that, you know, she, because she's somebody who Republicans constantly make fun of her and belittle her for calling her a bartender.
Bartender, right, yeah.
And the idea that we are finally getting to a place where, like, some people in retail environments, some service sector workers are asking to be, like, recognized for the fact that they actually do provide valuable labor to companies, and that just because their labor is different than coders doesn't mean that it's not valuable.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, do you think that being an Apple employee, like, in an Apple store is a job that should exist? If your answer is yes, then my follow-up question is, do you think that person should be homeless?
Right, exactly.
And your answer is no, then clearly they need to be paid more.
Well, and also, is there a difference between a good Apple store employee and a bad Apple store employee? Yes. So obviously the job involves skills. It's not a skill-less job. Because I think if you can ask that question of any job, then that's a skilled job.
Yeah.
Like, if there is a difference between a good and bad, literally name any job description. Because there's a difference between a good and bad hotel maid. There's a difference between a good and bad line cook. Or there's a good, you know, difference between a good and bad hotel concierge. Any job that is sort of, like, in and around the service sector.
Yeah.
Even the sort of behind-the-scenes jobs. There's a difference between a good and a bad server.
Yeah.
We all know that because we've all been to restaurants. And bad servers fucking suck.
Yeah.
And I'm boycotting my local coffee shop right now, over this exact issue, because I was sassily told that I could just learn to make coffee on my own. After just asking if I didn't even say anything judgmental. I just asked, why did the price go up? I didn't even ask why. I just said, did the price go up? And he said, you know, in 2 minutes on YouTube, you could learn to make this yourself. And I was like, I don't come to this coffee shop because I don't know how to make a latte. I come here because the experience of coming to the coffee shop is important to me.
Yeah.
And that relies on people skills, which you need to have as a service sector employee. In any case, my point is, there's such a thing as a good and bad any of these jobs. And if that's the case, then those are jobs that deserve to have living wages, benefits, and also share in the wealth of whatever enterprise they are contributing to.
Hello.
Because that's, in the case of Apple in particular,
they should be paid three times what they're
paying. An incredibly wealthy company, exactly. Yeah. We're not talking about a company that's just scraping by selling, you know, caterpillars to people. Listen, if you're at a Caterpillar store, I can see how the margins are pretty low. I don't know what kind of hourly rate you're expecting at a Caterpillar store, but I would expect a low one. I'm just saying, if you're Apple, you know, people are dropping $2,000 every time they come in there.
That's true.
In any case, that's the news this week.
Yeah.
Here's what we want to leave you with. It is your American duty right now to gossip.
To gossip, yep.
It is your time to, if you are a person who likes to make fun of whatever random celebrity scandal you just heard about, if you are a person who watches too much Bravo, if you are a person who doesn't watch any Bravo, but...
There's no such thing as watching too much Bravo.
All right, enough of that. But if you are a person who enjoys talking about literally anything that you have seen on TV, read on the internet, seen on Twitter, whatever it is.
Yeah, get into it. Lean in, guys.
You guys, lean in. This is a time that all of America could be engaged in one of the greatest gossip fests in American history.
Yeah.
And I think, let that be the unifying experience we have this summer.
I agree.
Let's bring America back together.
Yes.
Through the power of gossip.
Yeah.
And in the process, you'll be a patriot. That's the news this week. We'll talk to you next week, and hopefully we'll hear from you. We'll hear some exciting tidbits from you in the meantime.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye.